the possible eruption of 416 AD. The most frequently quoted source for the first, and perhaps also the second, of these three rather questionable event dates is a monumental modern history written in the 19th century and known as the Javanese Book of Kings. Its author, a Javanese court poet called Radan Ngabahi Rangawasita, was well connected to the Dutch colonial establishment of the day, as well as being a key figure in the most distinguished of traditional circles. He worked in the sultanly estate of Solo, which is unarguably the most refined of all Javanese courts, a place where the gamelan playing and the wayang kulit puppetry and the poetry still have few equals for their elegance, style and cultural purity. But for Rangawasita, who was intellectually as much scholar as poet, and who in particular knew the European historical record well, the courtly life was evidently not enough. He had as his principal ambition something more than the fashioning of lyrical poems to mark significant moments in the life of the Sultan of Solo. He wanted instead to create something of rather greater and enduring value, a truly comprehensive history of the entire island of Java, a document that could hold up its head alongside the great European tracts about their own countries and peoples. He spent most of his adult years working on the project, and in the 1860s, after decades of what must have been the most thankless toil, he finally achieved his goal, completing and uttering for publication a series of fascinating but undisciplined ramblings that make up what is possibly the world's longest book. Unfortunately, according to his many critics, most of what he wrote he made up. That being so, there has been an understandably cautious reaction among scholars who have tried to use Rangawasita's tome as the basis of any serious historical research. Scientists who have read it have been among the most sceptical of all, and most particularly volcanologists, who have been both drawn to and confused by one highly alluring passage, which reads, "The whole world was greatly shaken, and violent thundering, accompanied by heavy rain and storms, took place. But not only did not this heavy rain extinguish the eruption of fire of the mountain Kapi, but augmented the fire. The noise was fearful. At last the mountain Kapi, with a tremendous roar, burst into pieces and sank into the deepest of the earth. The water of the sea rose and inundated the land, the country to the east of the mountain Batuwara, to the mountain Rajabasa, was inundated by the sea. The inhabitants of the northern part of the Sunda country to the mountain Rajabasa were drowned and swept away with all their property." What does it mean? To which mountain, since Kapi is not a name known today, does the passage refer? And when did whatever happened take place? Geologists, more familiar with gazing at fossils or down microscopes, have pored over this one paragraph of elegant Javanese prose and gone over it with a fine-tooth comb. It would have all been a good deal more helpful and a sight less confusing if Rangawasita had only written once about the supposed great eruption. In fact, he went back to it twice. The paragraph quoted above comes from the 1869 version of his book. By the time of his second edition of 1885, he had decided to take another look at it, whatever, wherever, and whenever it was, and he wrote about it as follows. "In the year Saka 338, which is the equivalent of 416 AD, a thundering noise was heard from the mountain Butawara, which was answered by a similar noise coming from the mountain Kapi, lying westward of the modern Bantam. A great glaring fire, which reached to the sky, came out of the last-named mountain. The whole world was greatly shaken, and violent thundering, accompanied by heavy rains and storms, took place. But not only did this heavy rain not extinguish the eruption of fire of the mountain Kapi, but it augmented the fire. The noise was fearful. At last the mountain Kapi burst into two pieces with a tremendous roar and sank into the deepest of the earth. The water of the sea rose and inundated the land. The country to the east of the mountain called Batuwara, to the mountain Kamula, and westward to the mountain Rajabasa, was inundated by the sea. The inhabitants of the northern part of the Sunda country to the mountain Rajabasa were drowned and swept away with all their property. After the waters subsided, the mountain Kapi, which had burst into pieces, and the surrounding land became sea, and the single island of Java Sumatra divided into two parts. The city of Samaskuta, which was situated in the interior of Sumatra, became sea, the water of which was very clear, and which was afterwards called the Lake Singkara. This event was the origin of the separation of Sumatra and Java. The second of these two passages is more amply filled with geographical detail, the references to Sumatra and Java splitting apart, the identification of the Sunda country, and of volcanoes like Kamula, which is now known from other sources to be the western Javan volcano called Gede, south of today's Jakarta, and Batuwara in western Banten, and Rajabasa, which is a 4,000-foot peak at the southern tip of Sumatra, still bearing that name. Given all these circumstantial pieces of cartography, it looks more than likely that the mountain Kapi is in fact Krakatoa. But there's a small difficulty. The second description, filled as it is with journalistic colour, glaring fires, fearful noises, marine inundations, sea-destroyed villages, was written some 2 years after the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa, and since it is a much richer account than that written in 1869, to the sceptical eye it looks very much as though Ranga Wasita, having read all the newspapers and perhaps interviewed some residents of Banten, where most of the 1883 flood destruction took place, and having spoken to friendly Dutch officials and perhaps to a few scientists too, took his first account of 1869 and 15 years later, put bluntly, embellished it. He seems to have scattered some 1883 details, like glitter, on top of his rather bland descriptions of that earlier event. And by doing so, if that is what indeed he did, the poet suffers the inevitable fate of any writer of non-fiction who makes anything up. He finds that readers call into question everything that he writes. His entire history is then suspected of being flawed, and readers look, even at his first description of the explosion of Kapi and the inundations and deaths that followed, and wonder not just when it happened, but if it happened at all. Except, of course, and here I spring to Ranga Wasita's defence, at the time he wrote his first edition in 1869, he did not have any means of embellishing what he wrote. Yes, he might have seen accounts in the history books of the supposed eruption that took place in May 1680, but could he have made all of it up? Probably not. Most probably his writings for the first edition of the Book of Kings do come from his research into original sources. The trouble is, what sources? We know little of his historiography. We can only surmise that his description of an eruption in the Sunda Strait probably came from those ancient, peculiarly beautiful and very fragile Javanese manuscripts written on palm leaves, and of which the Kraton Library at Solo had a very great number. Matters here start to become somewhat vague. Of the 10,000 or so surviving palm leaf texts, which are written in a variety of manuscript styles, including Balinese, court Javanese, and a curiously complex calligraphy called mountain script, with which Ranga Wasita and only a handful of others was familiar, only a very small number actually relate the ancient history of Java. Most of them appear to stop, or start, in about the 9th century. Before that, very little of which we can be certain appears to be known about Java at all. To give some of the flavour of this uncertainty, there are references in Ranga Wasita's work to a mysterious monarch called Jayabaya, who supposedly oversaw the writing of the accounts of the eruption that are to be found on some of the older palm leaf texts. Jayabaya, in turn, is supposed to have been told about the eruption by a Hindu god named Narada, who descended from heaven and related fabulous stories that, he insisted to the king, should be inserted into all and any accounts of the history of Java. So here we have it, an account from an ancient god via an enigmatic 10th-century king who dictated material to scribes who wrote on leaves, and then through the good offices of a 19th-century court poet who, yes, could read those leaves, but who was clearly also a man much taken to flights of fancy. This provides us with the basic story of Krakatoa's first recorded eruption. Small wonder that the scientific community has received it with a healthy degree of scepticism. Except for two things. Firstly, the details are both very good, even the relatively unadorned first account of 1869, and are fairly geologically convincing. And secondly, there is a firm date given for the event, 416 AD. Of that, Rangawasita has no doubt. The Hindu god seemingly told Jayabaya that the event took place in the 338th year of the Shaka calendar, a widely recognised Hindu dating system used only on these islands, which began in Western terms in the year 78 AD, when Hinduism was supposedly brought south from the Champa kingdom in today's Vietnam. To get the modern date of 416, one simply does the arithmetic. But there is not one other shred of independent contemporary evidence, not a line of dust in any of the ice cores taken from either polar ice cap, not a millimetre of shrinkage in the size of any tree rings taken from any of the world's ancient forests, to suggest that there was any volcanic eruption anywhere in the world in the early part of the 5th century. The error rates from these techniques are in the range of plus or minus 25 years, so it seems clear from scientific evidence that no volcano of any consequence erupted in the world during the first quarter of the 5th century. That much appears certain. The Shaka year, those glaring fires, the inundations of the sea, and the explosion of the mountain Kapi notwithstanding. Without any firm scientific evidence, and with the historical evidence being little more than a vividly told tale from a Victorian poet fantasist, one has to wonder seriously whether there was a 5th century eruption of Krakatoa at all. The confusions of 416 AD or 535 AD. There is, though, quite abundant evidence that some kind of titanic event occurred about a century later. From a very considerable body of tree ring, ice core, and worldwide anecdotal evidence, it seems likely that a massive volcanic eruption occurred somewhere in the region of Java or Sumatra around 535 AD. Could this perhaps also be Krakatoa? Could perhaps the Shaka date in Rangawasita's history be an error, but all the other supposed observations, at least for his first account, be substantially correct? A slender and somewhat tenuous body of evidence suggests that this might be the case. The evidence derives from the observation that volcanoes, especially truly large ones that occur close to large bodies of habitation, trigger widespread social dislocation. People die in their hundreds, communications are severed, there is disease, ruin, a collapse of social order. And a barely recognised consequence of all this mayhem is that historical record-keeping suffers. It becomes patchy and incomplete. Historians, like everyone else, have little other than personal survival on their minds. And the Javanese Book of Kings exhibits this patchiness at just the right time. For all of the 5th century, the book contains its fairly routine and regular selections of entries. There appears to have been no interruption, no trauma that ever caused any historian to stop writing about Javanese trivia for any protracted period during the 100 years between 400 AD and 500 AD. That century on Java seems to have been blessed with an absence of awfulness. The year 416 AD appears with the account of the explosion itself, but very pointedly it appears not to have been followed by years of disruption, with historians taking time off from their duties to attend to their own needs. There is just as much inconsequential detail in the Javanese palm leaf history books for the 10-year period between 420 and 430, just as there was for the period from 400 to 410. But in the next century, the 6th, this is not the case at all. For the first 30 years of the 6th century, fully three-quarters of the years have journal entries, the normal strike rate, as it were. But for the 18 years that follow the crucial year of 535 AD, fewer than one-fifth of them display journal entries. And then for the 30 years following that, the rate of mention of ordinary matters rises back up to a little under three-quarters, which is more or less the normal rate. So it looks very much as though something occurred in or around 535 AD, something which sent the palm leaf scribes of Java into a tailspin, into a state of historical catalepsy for almost the following two decades. And what is more, there is confirming ice core and tree ring evidence aplenty from the world outside as well. Dating of both cores and trees is these days highly accurate, and within an error rate of 25 years, it does now seem that between the years 510 and 560 AD, some major event that sifted dust around the world and caused the sun to dim and arboreal growing conditions to slacken surely did happen. There's even a Chinese record attesting to a huge detonation heard at around that time, an account that moreover adds, and intriguingly, that the noise came from the south. From the south of China, in other words. And Krakatoa is, of course, due south of China. It would be stretching matters to say that any of this evidence is wholly convincing, but it seems fair to say that of those two supposed early eruptions, only the later, that occurring in 535, seems likely to have involved Krakatoa. The other record, if it's not simply a mistaken date, may have related to an eruption of any one of Java's other 20 active volcanoes, or it may simply be a mélange of myth, confusion, legend and embellishment, and may never have happened at all. The likely eruption of 535 AD. Assuming, then, that the first Krakatoa eruption did occur in 535 and not a century beforehand, it is fair to say, from what little we know of the social conditions in the Western Java of the time, that there were probably precious few people around to be aware of it. In particular, there seems to have been no city worthy of the name within 100 miles of the eruption. Chinese traders, ships' captains who made voyages along the northern and eastern coasts of Java and Sumatra, appear to have left the most comprehensive written records of the region. A number of these speak of a community of the time known as Sitiao, which was most probably on Java, and that was possessed of fertile lands and communities with streets. Another state, which in the annals of the Peking Mandarinate was called Putai, probably in southern Sumatra, was populated by a race said to be as black as lacquer, and whose members liked to row out from their settlements to sell chickens and fruit to the emperor's passing sailing junks. There are also records of a rather dyspeptic-sounding community called Holotan, whose people grumbled to the Chinese that they were unceasingly subject to attacks by their neighbours. And cannibals with tails, probably early versions of the ceremonial long headdresses, still to be found in parts of southern Borneo, also caught the attention of the Chinese court's punctilious scribes. But neither the Indian nor the Chinese traders who passed by with their gold and jade and sandalwood and cloves noticed either a large city nor any kind of sophisticated urban population in either Java or Sumatra. If fires lit the sky and torrents of ash and pumice rained down from the clouds, the people of Nusantara, the old Malay word meaning the islands between, who saw and heard and were duly astonished, horrified or hurt, were villagers only, artless country folk whose descriptions of those early and startling events were inevitably vague and imaginative. In 1999, a British television documentary based on a remarkable book, Catastrophe, by a London-based author named David Keyes, suggested powerfully that the 535 AD eruption of Krakatoa not only happened, but it was the primary cause of an extraordinary number of seemingly unrelated but world-changing events. The climate changes, triggered by the eruption, if that is what it was, helped to bring about an astonishing series of utterly apocalyptic happenings. Among these, the television programme suggested, were events of no less magnitude than the fall of the Roman Empire, the outbreak of the rat-borne Great Plague, the historyless miseries of the Dark Ages, the spawning of Islam, the invasion of Europe by the barbarians, the collapse of Central America's Mayan civilization, and the birth of at least 4 new Mediterranean states. The list goes on and on. And though the arguments promoting such ideas appear at times more than a little speculative, everything distills itself into a single fact. Something enormous did take place somewhere in the world in the first half of the 6th century AD, and it had a staggering effect on the world's climate. But what exactly was that something? A volcano, by all accounts. All of the very same available evidence that suggests that nothing at all took place in 416 AD indicates that something very major indeed occurred 119 years later. Dust in the ice cores, acid snows in Greenland and Antarctica, compellingly seductive data from thousands of tree ring samples, all of these point to an event somewhere in the first half of the 6th century. And, thanks initially to Rangawasita's writing, however unreliable, so the finger points alluringly to Krakatoa as the site for whatever that event might have been. Surprisingly, very few halfway reliable scientific tests have ever been undertaken to indicate the date of Krakatoa's previous eruptions. It somewhat defies belief to realise that science has been generally content to allow historians to determine the story of Krakatoa's past, when rather more accurate methods, radiometric dating principally among them, could give the answers to a degree of accuracy that poets to the court of Solo, unsurprisingly, could never really match. The television programme makers saw to it that this sorry state of affairs was remedied. In 1999, and as a response to the wide interest over the remarkable suggestions made in Catastrophe, the resident specialist on Krakatoa at the University of Rhode Island, Haraldur Sigurdsson, went on an expedition to Krakatoa to use the magic of modern chemistry to try and find a definitive answer to the puzzle that Rangawasita has set. He attempted this by taking samples of charcoal from various and evidently very ancient lava flows that he found on Rakata, the surviving relic mountain of the 1883 eruption. And on the samples he performed dating tests using the well-known half-life of the carbon-14 isotope. The results were, however, only moderately conclusive. The event that had burned the charcoal had occurred, Professor Sigurdsson was able to say, between 1 AD and 1200 AD. There had, in other words, been a very large volcanic eruption on Krakatoa during the first 1200 years of the Christian era, and it may well have been a large enough event to trigger the climate changes that would in turn cause the economic and social dislocations and the migration of plague-carrying rats that would cause the profound events that are the central thesis of Catastrophe. But as to whether that single event can be pinned down to any one year, and whether that year is likely to be 416 AD or 535 AD, there's no ready answer still. Perhaps only Rangawasita had any idea. The near-certain eruption of 1680 AD. Pure fancy was not so much of a factor 1,100 years later, however, when Krakatoa may have lifted her skirts once again. May have, though, has once again to be the operative phrase. We've already seen how possibly vague and imaginatively drawn were the descriptions of the supposed events of 416 and 535. There's no evidence at all for any eruptions during the Buddhist Kailendra period. The descriptions of whatever took place in 1680 do not exactly amount to a paragon of scrupulous exactitude either. As we've seen, there were just three European witnesses to what might have occurred. The silver assayer, named Johann Wilhelm Vogel, who first saw evidence of ruin on the island, the writer Elias Hess, who produced his all-too-vivid account of an event that, according to him, was still playing itself out more than a year later, and the unnamed captain of a Bengal trading vessel, the Ardenburg. The first two of these witnesses wrote accounts of a volcanic event that seem highly coloured, to say the least. And while the Ardenburg's master may well have spoken robustly of an eruption to attentive and well-lubricated audiences in Batavia's dockside bars, he seems to have written nothing in his log that was of sufficient interest to alert his masters in the castle. The official records, comprehensive in all other respects, are silent. Something did definitely occur on Krakatoa, of that there's little doubt, but whatever it was probably much less significant a happening than the eruption that seems to have taken place in the 6th century, not to mention what took place 2 centuries later. It did nonetheless take place within a respectable distance of a newly settled urban population. For Batavia, the primary company town of the Vereenige Oost-Indische Compagnie, the VOC, was, in 1680, a full 8 decades old, and it had attained some kind of settled maturity. It had a walled quarter and turreted administrative offices, a Chinatown and a collection of godowns, and any number of small terraced houses with streets and canals and taverns, forming a dreamy, steamy simulacrum of the VOC employees' much-missed homes back in faraway Amsterdam or Leiden, in Delft or Utrecht. The Dutch who settled in 17th-century Batavia were not an especially content people, by all accounts. Their lives were a succession of uncomfortable trials. They were seldom fully well, they tended to succumb to a variety of tropical ills, malaria, cholera, dengue fever, and they were morbidly afraid of the air on which they suspected the responsible germs were born. The foul smells from the coast, brought in by the sea breezes, which usually began to blow at breakfast time, prompted everyone in the city to keep their doors and windows firmly shut until dusk, and then to shut them once more soon after to keep out the evening mosquitoes. Everyone bathed in the city canals. The ladies unblushingly dived into these general public bathtubs, wrote one Bernard Vlecke, a custom which was vainly forbidden because the canals were used as sewers and were therefore rather filthy. And then there was the drinking and partying and the smoking and the slightly desperate merriment of colonial life. No less an authority than Jan Pieterszoon Koen himself, the founder of it all, had decreed the beneficial effects of spirits. Our nation must drink or die, he's quoted as having once remarked, an epithet the Dutch distilling industry still likes to remember today. The average 17th century Hollander in Batavia would take a glass of neat Geneva, or gin, before his breakfast, and would then while away the day consuming glass after glass of arrack as he sat sweltering in his dark, airless house. And with small Dutch cigars costing no more than a few guilders for a box of 1,000, with big Havana cigars costing only a few guilders more, and a nut of dark shag big enough to fill a meerschaum bowl, going for just a few cents, well, the Batavian air was always blue with tobacco smoke. Down by the Jakarta waterfront at Sunda Kelapa, there's still today the slenderest reminders of those times, barely preserved in a city that is eternally busy, endlessly and boisterously changing, and, given its bewildering jumble of races and religions, all too often bickering with itself, sometimes very violently. Down where the oily waters of the dock slap against the splintered timber piers, the old Dutch spice godowns or warehouses remain huddled among the tenements of the fish market. There's a massively built ship repair dock with flagstone floors and teak beams, now turned into a restaurant that serves rice duffel and ice-cold bintang. There's a portion of the old city wall with a round-topped lozenge of a sentry box, badly in need of care and repair. And there's the famous Culemborg Bastion, with a 19th-century watchtower and a customs office, Chinese characters carved into the floor, and it's said there's a marker that shows the hour meridian, the centre point of Java time. Bali being so far away east, it's an hour later, Aceh in Sumatra to the west, an hour before. But the loveliest sight in Sunda Kelapa today has nothing to do with the Dutch, the VOC, or seemingly with Krakatoa at all. It's far more elemental, far more timeless vision, the sight of the serried ranks of enormous and gaily painted wooden sailing ships, maybe 50 of them on a busy day, that are to be found tied up alongside the long quay. They are schooners known as pinisi, sailed by rough-and-ready Bugis sailors from Sulawesi, or by matelots from Kalimantan and the outer islands of the archipelago. They bring in wood, most often illegally cut from the great forests of Borneo and Sulawesi, to sell in the Jakarta market before the masters sail home with televisions and washing machines and the other necessities that are less easy to come by on the distant islands. In one of the local waterfront bars, I'd fallen in with a forester who had been kind enough to explain to me, over a number of beers, the nature of the distribution of harvestable and protected hardwood trees throughout the archipelago. Later in the afternoon, when it was still insufferably hot, he took me down to the cool of the docks and, to illustrate a point he was making about the ruin of Indonesia's rainforests, we walked past the ranks of the traders' boats, all moored on the slant, their enormous prows arching over the quayside, young men and pie dogs sleeping in the welcome shadows they cast. The forester had mixed views about the traders who owned and sailed the ships. He admired them for their courage, their seamanship, their daring do. He knew they travelled vast distances without proper navigational equipment. He liked their songs and poetry and wild romancing. He knew they would rarely permit a woman to sail on a vessel with them, and that their seafaring tradition was everything. He marvelled at the physical strength of the sailors, was amazed still, though he had lived on Java for 20 years, at the way the minute and wiry and barefoot Bugis sailors would unload huge bulks of mahogany, pieces weighing twice as much as a man, and carry them down narrow and slippery gangplanks. but it was the timber they carried that vexed him. These seamen were unwittingly a part of the distribution chain that turned rare Javanese teak into baubles for Western living rooms, and they should, in his view, be stopped. We went back to his flat in a miniature skyscraper on the edge of the fish market. He lived on the 20th floor with his Chinese wife and three children. He'd recently installed a steel front door, 4 inches thick, with bolts that made it look like the entrance to a bank vault. It was because of the anti-Chinese riots of 1998, he said, the scars and scorch marks of which were still everywhere to be seen in Glodok, the Chinese area south of the docks. Mobs of Javanese had raided his apartment that terrible day, had driven his wife and family into the street, had stolen everything they owned. They'd only left his wife alone because he was a Westerner, a foreigner. But though this was all fascinating, and though his views on the rainforests and the boogie traders were admirable, I found myself rather more enthralled by a picture that hung on his living room wall. It was a fine 18th-century etching by the well-known Dutch cartographer Jan van Schlei. It depicted two well-laden company ships, both heeling slightly before a good breeze, passing in front of an island with a pointed mountain. There was a row of trees a few feet up from the island's shore, but otherwise the island was made up of naked rock. Flaming from its summit were great tongues of fire and a roiling, boiling mass of dark smoke which towered above the pair of galleons and almost mingled with the clouds above. The picture was called simply Het Brandend Eiland, the Burning Island, and it was a depiction, without a doubt, of the otherwise little chronicled eruption that supposedly took place in 1680. He had picked up the etching in an antique shop in Yogyakarta some years before. He knew that it looked somewhat fantastical, more likely to be a figment of Van Schlei's normally restrained imagination than an accurate picture of a real happening, but it was a powerful image nonetheless, a reminder for his living room wall of the awful power of the volcano near which they all then lived, and a more general and emblematic reminder, given his own domestic circumstances, of the highly precarious and often highly tenuous nature of life in the East Indies. Before the certain eruption of 1883 AD. 2 centuries after the 1680 eruption that was pictured or imagined by Van Schlei, and when Krakatoa did finally make up her mind to explode and to do so cataclysmically, the city of Batavia had become in outward appearance an entirely different place. In the 1880s, it was no longer simply a company town for a start. War with Britain a century beforehand had essentially done for it. Naval blockades during the war had starved the VOC of cash and had kept thousands of tons of Java's choicest exports marooned in the Batavia warehouses. And then the Treaty of Paris of 1782, that ended the fighting in 1784, broke the Dutch trading monopoly in the region and placed huge financial burdens on the once grand, formerly secure company. The Dutch share in the world spice trade promptly dwindled, the revenues from the newly imported plantation crops of coffee, tea and quinine were never sufficient to balance the VOC's enormous expenses, and after 2 centuries of operation the weary old company had been declared bankrupt. Its commission to govern formally expired in 1799, and the Dutch government had taken charge of the East Indies as a purely colonial possession. 6 years later, Holland was overrun by forces of the globally ambitious French Emperor Napoleon I, who promptly installed his brother Louis on the Dutch throne. War with England then became, and remained for the next 10 years, the dominating reality of all European life. It was a reality that spread east to the Indies too, and specifically to Batavia, in her new role as the capital city of what was now called the Dutch East Indies. The British were on the prowl in the eastern seas. The Napoleonic Wars that raged in Europe had a considerable effect, much of it still very apparent today, on the way that the city of Batavia and the government that was run from it was allowed to develop. It was indeed a Napoleonic Marechal, one Herman Willem Dandels, who was to make the most evident changes, and who would determine the shape of the city which would exist at the time of Krakatoa's grand ultimate explosion. His orders, which he issued promptly on his appointment to the job of Governor-General in 1808, were simple. By any means possible and with no expense spared, he was to render Batavia proof from any possible British military attack. He chose to do this by formally abandoning all the castles and warehouses and fortifications at the seaside, effectively closing down what was dismissively called Benedenstad, the lower town, the old Batavia, and building an entirely new capital, 5 miles inland, made secure by its geography from any possible seaborne ambuscades. Old Batavia, the now squalid, cramped and run-down creation of Jan Pieterszoon Coen, had by the 18th century become notorious across the Orient as a pox-ridden graveyard for its resident Europeans. The new Batavia to the south would truly be worthy, he decided, of its long unrealized sobriquet, the Queen of the East. With this in mind, he decided to call his new uptown suburb Weltevreden, or Well-Contented, since that is what he fully expected its grateful Dutch residents to be. He tore down Batavia Castle and built for himself a palace on a vast plain of neatly clipped lawns, where the Governors General of the East Indies would maintain their city headquarters for decades to come. And as he moved the epicentre of administration, so genteel society moved with him, such that by the middle of the 19th century, a vacuum had been left in the old town, as the famous British coloniser Thomas Stamford Raffles was to note in 1817. "Streets have been pulled down," he wrote, "canals half filled up, forts demolished, and palaces levelled with the dust. The Stadhuis, where the Supreme Court of Justice and Magistracy still assemble, remains. Merchants transact their business in town during the day, and its warehouses still contain the richest productions of the island, but few Europeans of respectability sleep within its limits." By 1858, a passing Dutchman, A.W.P. Weitzel, was to amplify the theme. After sundown, Batavia is silent and empty. Not only the offices and large warehouses, but even the shops are closed. No carriage is heard any more, and the few indigenous people who move along the street make no noise at all on their bare feet, and if the police had not ordered them to carry torches, they would wander there as dark shadows. And though the first Thomas Cook Guide was written in 1903, 20 years following the eruption, it did manage to catch something of the atmosphere of the new city the Dandels had created out of the wreck of the old company town, and which was well into its full flowering at the century's end. "Whilst Batavia proper," the guide wrote, "the lower town with its counting houses and shops, its native and Chinese populations, its canals and moats, its dust and dirt and old-fashioned mansions, makes anything but a charming impression, the upper town, to which all Europeans return in the evening, reminds one of a gigantic park in which villas are built in rows and great trees shade the broad and gravelly paths and spacious squares bring air and wind." The years immediately before the eruption were stable, prosperous, expansive. Whatever setbacks the city had endured in the aftermath of the VOC's collapse at the end of the 18th century had been more than amply reversed in the more cosmopolitan, buccaneering, free marketeering years of the latter half of the 19th. The Suez Canal opened in 1869. An appetite for goods from the east, now far closer to European markets with the shortcut through the desert and ever faster ships on the routes, meant that new trading houses were springing up and new markets for new tropical commodities and wares were opening up on all sides. The population of Batavia, like that of other favoured eastern cities, began to grow, and fast. It jumped from 500,000 in 1866 to well over 1,000,000 at the time of the eruption, yet with merely 12,000 of those Europeans and 80,000 Chinese, the rest all native East Indians, understandably eager to take advantage of the growing wealth around them. As early as 1832, according to an account written by the renowned Dutch scholar of Javanese, Professor P.P. Roerda van Eisinger, there were widespread signs of an accelerating prosperity. Hundreds of carriages of European officials and shop people raising clouds of dust on the street, while the Chinese, with their recognisable and unpleasant features, with their long pigtails and silk caps, are everywhere busy hammering, sawing, painting, sewing, building, and so on. Rich Arabs and Chinese rode through the streets. Half-clad Javanese carried heavy loads. Shabby Eurasian clerks walked beneath their sunshades to their offices. Old women sold cakes. An Indian sat calmly eating his rice on a banana leaf. And vegetable, milk and fruit sellers, butchers and hill dwellers offering monkeys and birds, all mingled together in the crowd. This gathering crush of people and the ever-accelerating bustle and pace of Batavian life had a further effect, though. Just as in British India, so the wealthier and more influential of the European townspeople moved from the sweltering streets of the capital city up into the hills, to a cool and green town that the government promptly christened Buitenzorg, the Dutch equivalent of Without a Care, or the French Sans Souci, but which has now reverted to the native name it had before, the decidedly less carefree-sounding Bogor. Buitenzorg, just like its equivalent hill stations at Simla and Murray and Ootacamund in India, had already become a fashionable place at the beginning of the century, its reputation firmly anchored once Dandles had decided in 1808 to shift his personal headquarters to a great country house that had been built there by an 18th-century VOC commander. His officials warned him against trying to make the journey. In the torrential winter rains, they said it would take 30 teams of horses to get him there. "I shall use 31," he snorted, and promptly moved into what would be the principal palace for all the governors-general that followed him, Raffles included. The house survives today, essentially unchanged, a vast, one-storied, gleaming white palace, its immense airy rooms currently filled with pictures of well-endowed and slightly clad young women, the pictures and their subjects both equally assiduously collected, it's said, by Sukarno, who had brought modern Indonesia to independence. The parklands around the Istana are alive with thousands of roe deer imported by the Dutch a century ago to provide affordable and acceptable meat for the official banquets they so delighted in giving. The modern world then came with an unexpected suddenness to the Dutch-created world of colonial Java. In May 1844, Samuel Morse had transmitted the famous biblical message, "What hath God wrought?" from the Supreme Court in Washington to his colleague Alfred Vail, 40 miles away in Baltimore. 12 years later, and over almost exactly the same distance, the electric telegraph, which was to play such a crucial role in the spreading of the story of Krakatoa, was formally introduced to the Indies, with the great palace at Buitenzorg being connected in the summer of 1856 to the colonial offices down in Batavia. From then on, the pace of technological innovation in Java quickened. The island was connected internationally in 1859 with an undersea line to Singapore, though this failed after a few days, and then again in 1870, with links to both the Malay states and Australia. These proved to be totally stable, and so by the time of the Krakatoa eruption, the places where the explosion was seen and felt and heard and suffered were all connected by the dots and dashes of Mr. Morse's code to the world beyond. The eruption of Krakatoa was indeed the first true catastrophe in the world to take place after the establishment of a worldwide network of telegraph cables, a network that allowed news of the disaster to be flashed around the planet in double-quick time. The implications of this rapid and near-ubiquitous spread of information were profound, and to this extent they deserve a separate chapter, which I'll come to later. Houses in Batavia were connected with one another by telephone from 1882, such that gossip could spread as well as news and warning and invitations. There'd been a gasworks in the city and the luxury of piped gas for cooking and street lighting since 1862. The present gasworks still has one ancient gas-lit street lamp outside its office and which still sputters to life from time to time. There was a tramway, too, drawn by horses from 1869, with 10 of the tiny Sumbawan tram ponies dying every week, and then by noisy, dirty, ever-chuffing steam engines that ran from 1882 onwards, the poor, meaning the Indonesians, being forced to ride in carriages kept separate from the Europeans. Railway trains were first brought to Batavia by the Dutch government in 1869, with the first line, up to Buitenzorg, naturally, being completed in 1873. And also in 1870, that most potent symbol of European civility brought across to the Orient finally made it to Batavia. An iceworks was built. No longer did the Geneva-drinking Hollanders have to drum their fingers on the teakwood bars at the Harmony or Concordia Military Club, waiting for the ice ships from Boston, the vessels of what the Americans called the frozen water trade, to appear on the horizon off Sunda Kelapa. Now they could have locally made ice delivered to their fretworked port cochere doorsteps in Welteveraden every day, or sent to the Indish who worked behind the club bar. and they could be content in the knowledge that if the dinner party proved too boisterous, or the number of guests in the club altogether too many, the host could simply send out for more ice, and it would be there, available for delivery, fresh and dripping cold, every day of every following year. Everything in Batavia, wrote a well-satisfied traveller named W. A. Van Rees in 1881, is spacious, airy, and elegant. Thus was Batavia quite comfortably arranged at the approach of the critical year of 1883. There was an air of calm contentment in the land. A long-drawn-out guerrilla war between the Dutch and Islamic-led forces in Aceh and northern Sumatra was proving costly for the Batavian government, but was otherwise of no great moment to the citizenry. The traders in Batavia were doing well. Just as in Kansas City, everything here was up to date. Modern conveniences were being installed for the Europeans, and the huge number of Andagenes flooding into the city each day was, if nothing else, testament to the capital's ever-growing wealth. The planters out in the countryside were rich as well, but their contentment was tinged by the ever-present caution of the farmer, a man dependent on so many more factors than his own efforts. The newspapers of the day display an increasing concern in the 1880s, for example, that disease and blight might well ruin the crops, and so the Java planters began a programme of experimentation and diversification, bringing in robuster coffee plants from the Congo, for example, to ease the times when blight affected their Arabica or Liberia bushes. Prospectors found tin and began working it on the islands of Banka and Biliton, with the brother of the then Dutch king, Willem III, the main promoter of the Billiton Tin Company. Wildcatters drilling shallow wells in Borneo found oil as well, though it would be some years before they thought it worth extracting, and many more years before the establishment of the huge combine that would one day become Royal Dutch Oil. Plant importers, already delighted by the success of the cinchona bark trees that produced as much of a seventh of their weight in pure quinine, brought in new rubber trees from Brazil. One of the ships carrying the precious seeds bound for the botanical gardens in Buitenzorg was passing through the Sunda Strait on the very day of the eruption. Back in Holland, the moody and clumsily undiplomatic King Willem III was on the throne. In November 1880, he made a surprise appointment. Frederick Schjacob, a 58-year-old former sailor, mapmaker and sugar manufacturer, who for the previous 10 years had been Director-General of the Dutch Railways, was to go to Batavia as Governor-General. He took up his appointment the following April, 1881, and conducted himself during his first years in office with an unassuming efficiency. There was a great deal of ceremonial about the tasks of a Dutch colonial Governor-General, and it was not at all out of the ordinary to see Mr. Schjacob in an official uniform that was adorned, the better both to impress the natives and maintain the morale of the settlers, with yards of ornate gold brocade trim, with silver and enamel stars and red and white and blue ribbons and garters, with knee breeches and a tall felt hat with a feathered brim and a wild cockade. He wore it for the first official function of 1883 on the 19th of February, for the formal celebration of the official birthday of his faraway Dutch king. Although the birthday party in Batavia was a fine and formal affair, marred by nothing more untoward than a general eagerness for strong drink, nearly 90 miles away, in a straight line to the west of the palace, something was stirring deep within one of the menacingly dark and forest-clad pinnacles at the northern end of the Sunda Strait. The island with its pointed mountain, first noticed and named almost 300 years before, and which had been placid and beautiful for so very long, was now becoming restless again. Chapter 5. The Unchaining of the Gates of Hell. The rains are usually terrible in Java in the early part of the year, and the February of 1883 was no exception. There were floods in the lower-lying parts of old Batavia, and dozens of country roads were impassable. When the adjutants of the garrison artillery regiments inspected the city parade grounds on Waterloo Plain on the afternoon of Sunday the 18th, they found the glutinous red mud simply too deep for their cannon wheels. So they sent a message, via the aide-de-camp, to Governor-General Schjacob up at his great white palace at Buitenzorg, the traditional military parade that had been planned for the following morning to offer loyal birthday greetings to his faraway Imperial Majesty, King Willem III, could not, it was greatly regretted, go ahead. Some might have seen the cancellation as an omen. It was in any case not a happy time for the Dutch monarchy. The then head of the House of Orange, whose official titles included King of the Netherlands and Grand Duke of Luxembourg, and whose full and magisterial-sounding name was Willem Alexander Paul Frederick Lodewijk, belonged firmly to the glittering European aristocracy of a belle époque, an aristocracy that was only a very few years away from the corrosive effects of revolution and war, and which was then neither wise enough nor prescient enough to realise it. Willem, whose 66th birthday fell on the 19th of February, was a less than inspiring monarch. He'd been on the throne for 34 years, was weary, moody, rigorously anti-Catholic, and notoriously undiplomatic, and was keenly frustrated by the limitations that had been imposed on the powers he had known as Crown Prince, and which had been savagely cut back by the constitutional reforms initiated by his own father, Willem II. But out in the distant colonies of the East, such regal maunderings were either unheard or ignored. Monday, the 19th of February, King's Day, was the culminating moment for a whole weekend of midwinter festivities. The party started on the Saturday in the Willem III Grammar School with a dance which the elite of the capital were expected to attend. The Governor-General came down by special train from his mansion, made a speech welcoming everyone to the three-day Saturnalia, inaugurated the dancing with a waltz with his wife Leonie, admired the young girls' extravagantly full ball gowns, waspishly noted by the columnist of the Locomotive, a local newspaper, as being fully a year behind the fashions of Paris, took part in the traditional 11 o'clock conga, and then took himself off home, leaving the partygoers to dance themselves into the kind of frenzy that was only permissible in a servant-rich colony with a long weekend of indolence and celebration stretching ahead. It was a busy time for the Governor-General. On the Sunday he had church service to attend, arms to dispense, military parades to bless, and to hear the unwelcome news about the weather and the consequent cancellation of the following day's cavalry tattoo. And then on that next day, the Monday, Siakob had to get himself gussied up in his finest raiment once again and travel down from Buitenzorg to the sweltering and now rain-soaked capital for the much more formal but paradeless day of festivities. Every Dutch building was festooned with red, white and blue flags, and the ships in the harbour flew pennants and signal bunting. In Waterloo Plain, with its palaces and military barracks, thousands of soldiers, both the regular officers from Holland and levies from the loyal races throughout the islands, were arrayed in tidy ranks for inspection. The King's representative in the Indies, who, when he deigned to come down to hot and steamy Batavia, held court at his immense and newly completed white marble Doric-columned palace on the Konings Plain, the King's Square, staged an official morning audience that day. He ordered to be arrayed before him his entire council for the Indies, his senior civil servants, the generals and the bishops, and for the foreign diplomats, including the British consul-general, a Mr. Cameron, and his American counterpart, Oscar Hatfield, and the favoured elite of Batavia High Society. He announced, as was customary, an amnesty for a slew of prisoners. He also told his sweltering audience that a dozen or so banned persons, the concept of banning, so much a feature of later apartheid rules in that other former Dutch possession in southern Africa, was very much in force in the East Indies of the time, were to be relieved of their ordeal as a birthday bounty from the representative of His Majesty. The rest of the happy day was then devoted either to games, which included cricket, a sport that had infected the East Indies after a visit from the Singapore Cricket Club 10 years before, or to parties at the two principal clubs, the Harmony and the Concordia Military, and to a massive public display of fireworks. The Governor-General gave a gala dinner at the palace, reported the next day's Javish Courant in the breathlessly sycophantic tones of the Times. The palace was magnificently decorated and illuminated. All of the high authorities of the colony were invited, and they cheered with delight when the Governor-General raised his glass to the health of the King. Then there were wonderful fireworks on the Koningsplein, and thousands of people came out in the evening to enjoy the sight. Whether the worse-than-usual rains and the attendant cancellations were seen as any kind of augury or not, all seemed otherwise perfectly normal in a colony that this day of celebrations had already demonstrated was run with strict and meticulous order. The colonised people were at this time in their history by and large content. The merchants were prosperous. The big Javanese cities, Batavia, Surabaya, Bandung, Yogyakarta, Solo and Anyer among them, were generally peaceful and well-mannered. And yet, unknown to all but a few academics and seers, and to a few in those deeper recesses of Javanese and Sumatran cratons, where the sultans lived and ruled, a slew of strange and unrecognised forces were busying themselves. Social, political, religious, economic forces that would erupt across the colony within just a very short while. The seeds of impending troubles, of risings, insurgencies, militancies that would in time mature to become generally anti-imperialist and specifically anti-Dutch, were just then starting to take root, were growing unseen like mushrooms in the dark. We'll return to them later. For now, they provide the faintest, barely audible bass continuo sounding beneath the more dramatic events that were to dominate the year. Whatever might have been then going on beneath the outwardly content surface of East Indies society, it happened that at this very same time quite another array of unseen forces, and which some historians would later link with the coming societal changes, were also gathering. These, though, were physical forces, forces related to the then unrecognised phenomena of tectonics and subductions and fault zones and seafloor spreading, forces which were regrouping after years of quiescence and which now, just as invisible as the coming changes in politics and social life, had begun to prepare for their awakening once more. They were at work particularly beneath the surface of Western Java, readying themselves for a six-month period of violent and nightmarish activity. They would first become apparent, and violently so, just a scant 90 days after the smoke and flames and thunder of the last fireworks of His Majesty's birthday party had died away. It began with a sudden trembling. At first it was slight, more of a quivering of the air, a series of windy rumblings, of vague flutterings of atmosphere that were barely to be noticed at all. In normal times they would probably have passed without comment, other than by some Dutch planter in a bar who might point with amusement to the surface of his Geneva and get others to peer down at how shaken and rippled it was. Seismic events where the rocks themselves moved were a commonplace throughout the islands. Earthquakes and eruptions seemed as everyday as thunderstorms and plagues of mosquitoes. But this one was a little different. For a start, the year had already been curiously quiet across the entire colony. Between January and May, the observatory at Batavia had logged only 14 earthquakes, and of these 4 were in eastern Java and 7 in Sumatra. The year was calm. People were lulled into a kind of easy complacency. And western Java was in any case a quietish corner of the archipelago, seismically speaking. Everyone had heard the stories about ancient eruptions, true, and there were those who looked at maps and thought that they had heard tell of when Java and Sumatra were one island, and that they had broken apart during some terrific volcanic event long ago. But most believed that Krakatoa was long since extinct, inactive, quiescent, peaceful, and most likely dead. The Batavians who came out from town to swim on the clean white western beaches, the local bird sellers who hawked pretty Anyer swallows to passengers on the ships setting off for the long sea passage back to Europe, the bumboat skippers who sold fruit and coral and curios to seaborne passers-by, all thought of this corner of their islands as endlessly tranquil, a place far removed from the more violent activity that was so common near mountains like Bromo or Merapi or Merbapu. But then the vibrations began. It was just after midnight, early on the morning of Thursday the 10th of May, that the lighthouse keeper at what was then called First Point, the more southerly of a pair of lights on the enormous rocky headland at the southeastern entrance to the Sunda Strait and known to approaching mariners as Java Head, felt what he knew only too well was a tremor in the air. The lighthouse seemed suddenly to shift on its foundations. The sea outside whitened, appeared to freeze briefly, as we now know it does above a depth charge, then became uncannily smooth like a mirror, shivered briefly again, and then returned to its usual sickly swell. It was really nothing much. There was no suggestion of where the vibration might have come from. The keeper checked his records. The last volcano to erupt anywhere nearby was Lamongan, and that lay 600 miles to the east. Whatever had prompted this particular rumbling was probably closer than that. Though it caused no obvious damage, it was strong enough, unusual enough, and curious enough in location for the lighthouse keeper to log it and to note in a report that he wrote during the following weekend and sent off to Batavia with his other weekly summaries. 5 days after the initial vibration, the same happened again, except that this time the vibration was stronger and more sustained and was felt more widely. What had been felt in West Java was now felt on the other side of the Sunda Strait, in Sumatra. The Dutch controller, in the South Sumatran town of Ketimbang, Willem Beierink, was sufficiently roused by the thudding, rumbling bangs occurring beneath his feet on the night of the 15th of May, that he was moved to send a telegram, an official confidential message, to present all the facts to his superior, the resident of Lampong. It took him 5 further days to pluck up the courage to send it. He had to make sure he was right. But in the end, he made the call. Powerful tremors, he reported, were now being felt continuously up and down the Sumatran coast on the northern and western side of the strait. This was the first official word that something untoward was in the offing. And coming from a civil servant with the rank of controller, the news had considerable weight. Controllers in the colonial service of Holland were not a breed of men given to panic. The ships were the next to take note. The Sunda Strait, 17 miles across at its narrowest, was then, as today, a frantically busy waterway. The number of vessels passing between Java and Sumatra on the way to and from Europe and the Americas on one hand and China and the more distant reaches of the East on the other was in the 1880s prodigious. There were at least 10 ships in the vicinity when Krakatoa's first eruption began. Those definitely known to be nearby included the American brig, the A.R. Thomas, the British bark Actea, commanded by a Captain Walker, the Dutch mail packet Zeeland, commanded by a Captain Mackenzie, on her way from Batavia to the Indian Ocean, and then by long sea to the Netherlands, the Sunda, a steam ferry boat skipping her way from Batavia to a series of local ports, the Archer, an Australian passenger steamship of the Queensland Royal Mail Line, the Conrad, a Dutch mailboat heading northwards from Europe to Batavia, a Dutch bark, the Haag, under the command of a Captain Ross, the German warship Elizabeth, heading south from Singapore, and, more mundane than romantic, the hoppers Samarang and Bintang, both shuttling between Java and Sumatra, performing harbour drudgery on behalf of the Batavia Port Authority. Each one of these had a story to tell. The first to note anything unusual in the log was the Elizabeth, a German corvette returning home to the motherland after 2 years in China and Japan, time spent doing picket duty on the Imperial Navy's Far Eastern Station. The ship had called briefly at Singapore, had bypassed Batavia, but had instead stopped at Anyer to take coal and take on water and to drop off a single passenger. The Elizabeth left the tiny port's quayside on the morning of Sunday, the 20th of May. She turned towards the south and trimmed her sails and set a course that would take her down the Sunda Strait and out into the open ocean. Her master, a Captain Holman, then became the first European to see the very beginning of the eruption of the mountain. He was the first to write a report about what now seemed to be behind all the rumbling and trembling that had been noticed around the region since the lighthouse keeper's first summary of the curious vibrations that he had experienced earlier in the month. It was 10:30 on the hot, cloudless summer morning. Captain Holman was looking from his bridge directly across to starboard towards the 2,625-foot southern summit of Krakatoa, when suddenly something took place that he never imagined possible. Without warning, he wrote, "We saw from the island a white cumulus cloud rising fast. It rose almost vertically until after about half an hour it had reached a height of about 11,000 metres. Here it started to spread like an umbrella, probably because it had reached the height of the anti-trade winds, so that soon only a small part of blue sky was seen on the horizon. When at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon a light south-south-easterly breeze started, it brought a fine ash dust which increased strongly until the entire ship was covered in all parts with a uniform fine grey dust layer." faced with the astonishing sight of a white cloud that was streaking up into the heavens, reaching to what his navigating officer calculated was fully 7 miles into the clear blue sky, the ship's marine chaplain, Father Himes, allowed himself a little more latitude than his superior in the Imperial Navy and wrote, "The crew had assembled on the upper deck in clean Sunday clothes to be mustered in divisions. The commander had just looked at the parading crew and started to inspect his pretty, clean ship when a certain motion was noticed among the officers which were assembled on the upper deck and bridge in their Sunday clothes. Glasses and heads all turned towards the lonely countryside in which the shores of Sumatra and Java coincided with the small island of Krakatoa. There, at least 17 nautical miles distant, an enormous shining wide vapour column rose extremely rapidly to half the horizon and reached within a short time the colossal height not below 11,000 metres, contrasting in its light-coloured snow-like appearance with the clear blue sky. It was convoluted like a giant wide coral stock." At this point, the Right Reverend's prose turns rather more purple than he probably would on reflection have wished. He compares Krakatoa's rising plume of steam and smoke first to a giant cauliflower, then to a billy club, next to the convoluting steam column from the smokestack of a gigantic standing steam locomotive, and finally to a curious confection that he christened three-dimensional steam balls. Mercifully, after only a few lines of such description, he abandoned his quest for literary permanence and returned to writing for his parishioners back home, who were no doubt eagerly awaiting his return to the pulpit. In doing so, he provides some highly useful evidence for those who would later study this first phase of the eruption. "We did not hear any detonations. The veil over the sky was so dense and uniform that the almost full moon was only barely visible during the night. On the next morning, the ship, which was so clean 24 hours ago, looked very strange. It looked like a mill ship, or more precisely, like a floating cement factory. On the outside, everything, ship's wall, torpedo pipes, the entire masts, etc., was covered uniformly with a grey, sticky dust. It had accumulated thick and heavy on the sails. The steps of the crew sounded muffled. The people enjoyed collecting the lava dust as polishing material, and it was not very heavy work to collect the stuff in sacks and boxes. The sky above this ash rain disaster appeared like a large bell made of rather dull milky glass, in which the sun hung like a light blue lamp. For another 75 German miles, we had to sit in the evening with our faces looking backwards as we sat together trying to get some air. The distribution of the ashfall would be over an area at least as large as Germany." One by one, the other ships in the neighbourhood reported the news. Some of the reports were made public within days or weeks of the event. In later years, the logs were found and published, or there surfaced private letters from the amazed commanders or crew, as well as messages from passengers who had been aboard and knew that they had seen something strange and wanted, earnestly, to tell of it. The British ship Actea, for instance, which was sailing 80 miles west of Krakatoa, noticed a peculiar green colour in the morning skies to the east-southeast. By mid-afternoon her sails and rigging were covered in fine ash and dust, and when the sun set it did so as a silver ball. The hopper Samarang, en route to the port of Merak, felt a sudden swell, massive enough to lift her and her screw clear out of the water. The Zeeland, sailing with her full complement of passengers and mail back towards Holland, passed within 5 miles of Krakatoa. Her compass needle suddenly began to spin round and round, uselessly. When it settled, it showed a deviation from normal of 12 degrees. Steam and debris then roared up from the most northerly of the three cones that could be seen on the island, and to the crew a deafening noise began to sound, seeming to them to combine the thunder of heavy artillery and the rattle of continuous machine-gun fire. Captain Mackenzie next saw, to his astonishment, a huge column of black cloud, not white, despite what others had said. He was sure it was at this moment black, rising swiftly above the mountain, with lightning flashes deep within the clouds and a continuous crackling sound. The sea all around the island was punctured by immense grey water spouts rising into the air. It became so dark he had to reduce speed to 5 knots. There being no radio at the time, he frantically raised a string of coloured signal flags, alerting all who might be watching him, and the Lloyd's agent at Anyer certainly was, for he noted it in his log, that he was fast standing into danger, to use the maritime phrase, and others who came near him might suffer the same fate. And then came the moment when a Delft dinner plate fell off a dining-room table in the old part of Batavia and broke into 1,000 pieces.